Les conférences du Collège de France.
Before I start, I'd just like to say how much I've enjoyed giving these lectures so far, and I'd like to thank the Collège de France and Foundation Hugo and Professor François Recanati for inviting me. It's been a pleasure. So this is now lecture 4, and I've got quite a lot to get through, so I won't read all that. I'll just move along. And today I'm going to add some metaphysics to the semantic issues I've been talking about so far. I'm going to talk both about metaphysical modality and about the mind-body problem. But as you'll see, the things we've been talking about so far will inform my discussion of these issues. So let me start. Quite a lot of this lecture will be about Kripke and Kripkean themes. So let me start with naming and necessity. And goodness, that's a new typeface. I think I can live with that. Sorry about that. I don't know where it came from. So one of the most striking features of naming necessity was its way it introduced philosophers to a posteriori necessities. I don't know how many of us here can remember before Kripke, but when I was an undergraduate, the idea that there was anything to necessity apart from analyticity, a prioricity, didn't make sense. In fact, I can remember thinking people who thought that kind of thing, there were one or two, the Niels, my old professor Gert Buchdahl, I thought they were kind of corrupt somehow, crazy. I can remember my first philosophy book was Language, Truth and Logic, and if you look up necessity in the index of Language, Truth and Logic, it says see a priori. Right, but Kripke pointed out, and didn't take much to persuade us, that there are plenty of a posteriori truths that are clearly necessary. Proper name identities, Hesperus's Phosphorus, Cary Grant is Archie Leach. Could Cary Grant not have been Archie Leach? Could Marilyn Monroe not have been Norma Jean Baker? Doesn't really make sense. My father was Owen Papineau. Could I have had a different father? Could it be a possible world in which I didn't have Owen as father? Would be a possible world in which I wasn't there. Could water not consist of H2O molecules? And so, could humans not be descended from the original humans, from apes? Again, it seems not to make any metaphysical sense. And the case I'll be looking at, and this is contentious because this won't strike so many people as obviously true. Maybe they'll see it's necessary if it were true, but I doubt it's true. That experiences, conscious experiences, like, say, having the experience as of seeing something red, are one and the same as certain neural processes. I'll be talking about neural oscillations in V4, area of the visual cortex, as what experiences, sensory experiences, visual experiences are. So here are claims that you need to investigate in order to find out that they're true. Somebody can know who David Papineau is, know who Owen Papineau is, and not know that he's my father. You could know about humans and about apes and not know that humans are descended from apes. I mean, it requires a posteriori information to ascertain these necessities. So there's two questions here. One is, why are these truths necessary? And the second is, why are they a posteriori? And I regard these as both rather deep and interesting issues. I think Kripke pointed us to things that we hadn't really appreciated before, been sensitive to before. I mean, things that were off the philosophical agenda. But not everybody agrees about this. And plenty of philosophers, perhaps most philosophers, who knows, offer what I think of as rather shallow answers to both those questions. So here's one answer to the question of why are those claims necessary? Why is it that my parenthood is essential to me, but say my birthplace isn't? I mean, intuitively we feel I couldn't have had a different father or mother, but I could easily have had a different birthplace. I mean, I was, as it happened, born in Como, but that's because my father was working in Milan at the time. But, you know, he could have taken a different job. I could have been born in London. But could I have a different father? No. Why is that? Well, many people think that's just a conceptual truth. That's just the kind of way we think about people. It so happens that our concept of people builds parents into the identity of people, but doesn't build birthplaces in. So people say the same thing about chemical substances in the molecular constitution. Here's water, and as it happens, we think that the chemical constitution is what goes with water across counterfactual thinking. But we could have done it differently. We could have thought of water as just a odorless, colorless liquid, watery stuff, and held that fixed across possible worlds. If something's odorless, colorless, and tasteless, then necessarily it's water. We could have done it like that, we just don't. That's what I think of as the shallow answer. And in truth, there are various things that Kripke says, I guess, in Naming a Necessity, but certainly subsequently that suggests it's just a conceptual matter that certain Kripke conditionals are true. Here's a Kripke conditional. If somebody has a certain parent, then necessarily they have that parent. If some chemical substance has a certain molecular constitution, then necessarily it has that constitution. And the shallow thought is that this just happens to be part of our concepts of parents, of people, part of our concepts of chemical substances. So that's the answer to why are the necessary truths necessary. Just that our concepts happen to endorse certain Kripke conditionals. What about the a posteriority? Here's the shallow answer. The shallow answer hinges on the traditional idea that if you're thinking of some entity, if you're referring to some entity in thought, then you must have identifying knowledge of it, and identifying knowledge either comes directly via being, in some sense or other, I'm not going to pause on exactly in what sense, being acquainted with the object, and it either comes from acquaintance or it comes from an identifying description. And the thought is that, well, if you're thinking of something directly, then all its logical and definitional features will be available to you a priori. But if you're thinking of it at second hand, then not necessarily so. You're thinking of the object at arm's length, then it can have some logically specified features that you don't know about. And that's where the a posteriori comes from, because you're thinking of something indirectly. This kind of setup, we might associate it with Russell, gives rise to the, I'm not saying notorious, maybe not everybody thinks of notorious, the conceivability possibility principle. If I conceive of a necessary truth as being false, if I conceive an impossibility, so I conceive that David Papineau has a different parent from Owen, clearly I can do that. Well, I can't be thinking of David Papineau directly, because then his essential features would be available to me. I must be thinking of him via some contingent description. And then there'll be a possible world in which the object picked out by that contingent description, maybe the person who bears the name David Papineau has a different parent from Owen. So the thought is, if ever I can conceive of an of a necessity being false, there must be some possible situation where it is false. Now, I'm not going to question these two shallow answers. And first, the first one, that it's just a matter of convention that we regard certain features of entities as essential to them. Well, maybe the necessity of identity is just forced on us by logic. And we can, the issues here about which features of our thinking commit us to quantifying into modal context. But if you do quantify into modal context, you're going to have to accept the necessity of identity. But certain other a posteriori necessities don't seem to fit this model at all. I mean, why are parents and not birthplaces essential to people? I mean, why is constitutions essential to chemical substances? I don't think that's just a matter of convention. I think a community, you can imagine a community that talks about people, could refer to people, they knew what people are, but took their birthplaces to be essential to them, but not their parents. Now, you couldn't have been born in a different place, David Papineau. You could have had a different parent, but you couldn't have been born in a different place from Coma. I don't think they just have a different concept of people. I think they'd be wrong. They'd be substantially wrong. That's not true. It's not true that my birthplace is essential to me in the way that my parenthood is. And the same with chemical substances. It's just not true that the parents is essential to chemical substances in the way their molecular constitution is. Now, in fact, I think I've got an explanation of why we adopt the Kripke conditionals that we do. And I think it falls out of something I touched on in earlier lectures. And this is the idea that Millikan calls substances. Substances are entities whose instances share many properties. I talked about them back in lecture one as the feature of the world that allows us to represent great bodies of information in a very economical and easily processable way. And I want to show you that the same features of the world account for the necessity of certain features of objects, account for why we have the Kripke conditionals that we do. So the idea of substances is that they're entities in which, put it like that, the instances of the entities share many properties. So chemical substances are the obvious one. All the instances of gold, all the samples of gold share the same, and there's a pile of things. Density, color, conductivity, electrical conductivity, heat conductivity, disposition to combine with other substances in certain ratios, and so on. A large number of properties cluster in the instances of gold. Same with biological taxa. I mean, Mill's example. Mill was one of the first to point to this feature of substances. All the horses, he say, they share a certain shaped neck, they share manes, they share tails, they share hooves, they share a certain rather strange digestive system. You notice an animal that's got one of those features, you can infer that they've got others. It's not just a matter of definition. These features cluster together, they're correlated, they predict each other. That's why if you notice that the entity has one of them, one of those features, you can predict more or less it will have all the others. Persisting objects you can think of as analogous to this. Persisting objects are just ordinary things like this computer or me. And they persist through time. And you can think of the instances as the time slices of them. If you don't like time slices, just think of your encounters with persisting objects. You keep on meeting them. And the things that you meet will share a lot of properties. Take me. I have a certain accent. I have a certain physiognomy. I have a certain gait. And you notice that an individual's got one of those. You can predict all the others. So again, all these features cluster together. Across slices of individuals, you get strong correlations of a bunch of features. And you might wonder, it's a perfectly good question, why is it that in substances, I mean, take any substance, why is it that these features cluster in this way? This is something that calls for explanation. I mean, here's a general principle, the principle of common cause. If two properties are correlated, either one's causing the other or they have a common cause. The kind of cases we're looking at doesn't look like the different properties cause each other. The horse's mane doesn't cause its digestive system, nor vice versa. My gait doesn't cause my appearance of my face, nor vice versa. There must be some common cause. And in fact, if you think about all these cases, there is something like a common cause. In the case of chemical substances, the common cause of all these clustered properties is the molecular constitution. That explains why all the samples of gold have same boiling point, same melting point, and so on and so on. It's because they're all made of a certain kind of atom. With biological taxa, you might, there's debate about this, should we think of their genomes as the common cause? I think that doesn't work right. I think it's better to think of their shared ancestry as the common cause. Millikan divides substances into those that have an internal, intrinsic common cause, like the chemical substances, and those that have historical common cause. They're all copied from the same originals. I think biological taxa fit the second kind. They're historical substances. I think persisting objects you can think of like biological taxa, except they're a bit different because it's not that all the descendants are part of the same thing. You can have twins branching off. But still, the reason that for many of my properties, all of my stages have those properties is because they're all copied from the same original, or they're all copied from earlier ones. And in line with this, it's natural to think of the super-explanatory property, the property that explains all the other properties, as essential to the entity. Think of it like this. I mean, you take away the super-explanatory property, you kind of take away everything else. I mean, normally when we think counterfactually, if I'd been born in London, well, maybe a few, but most of my other properties would still be there. If I had different parents, you take away everything. Imagine that I had five fingers. Imagine I had six fingers. Well, you can imagine that, and most of the rest of the days. Imagine that I'm not descended from humans. Now it's not clear what you're supposed to imagine. So when we think counterfactually, we tend to take the entity in question to go with its super-explanatory property. So that's the reason why we have the Kripke conditionals we do. I mean, it's a matter of a posteriori fact that certain features of me are essential, certain features of substances in general are essential to them. It's not just a matter of convention. If there's a convention here, it's a convention that constitutes modal space. If X has super-explanatory property Y, then necessarily it has that property. I'm happy to think of that as a kind of aspect of our concepts of modal space. But the more specific Kripke conditionals depend on a posteriori facts. That's why I think the shallow answer to why certain features of entities are essential is wrong. Now for the shallow answer as to why they're a posteriori. And what I want to say here is there's no need to bring in identification by contingent description to explain a posterior necessity. His idea was you were thinking of something at second hand because you were thinking about it by description. Here's a much simpler story, and I think a more interesting one, is that thinkers don't need identifying knowledge of the reference of their concepts at all. You can just be related to them in the appropriate way. Your information about the thing you're thinking of might be very limited. Reference is fixed by external relations to the objects of thought. I talked about that in the last lecture. I talked about what ultimately makes it the case that a certain concept refers to some object. And I said, think about that in terms of what makes it the case that whole thoughts have the truth conditions they do. And the answer that came out is that thinkers will be thinking. Think about thinkers consuming a representation in terms of drawing certain inferences, performing certain actions as a result of having a representation. And think of producers, perhaps your sensory systems, perhaps other humans, as the producers of the representation. And what do the terms in the representation refer to? Well, it's that item in the world, such that it pays the consumers to interpret the claimers about that in the inferences and actions they perform. The item in the world, such that it's functional for them to respond in a certain way. And as we saw in standard cases, and not necessarily all cases, that item will just be the origin of the practice of accumulating information about the referent. And this, of course, is very much in line with Kripke's account of the referential value of proper names in naming necessity. There's nothing in there, if you remember, about identifying descriptions. Certain interpreters of Kripke have come along later and said, well, he has in mind that there's an identifying description. But the basic story, if you remember, is there's an origin and the name spreads, and now the name in the mouths of later users just refers to what was at the origin of the practice. And the users might have, the thinkers might have very little identifying information of the object. I mean, incidentally, I'd just like to throw this in. I mean, I think of this as kind of manifestation of the naturalist turn in philosophy, middle of the last century. Here's Kripke. He's thinking about subjects and their relations to the content of their thoughts from the outside. Here we are, here's the thinker, here's the world, here's relations. No need to think of somehow the grasp of the world being projected from the inside. Nothing difficult about the idea. Two thinkers could be just the same inside, but referring to different things. Nothing difficult about broad contents from Kripke's point of view. The relation between thoughts and things is being viewed from the outside of the subject. And it's quite interesting to compare Kripke, who you mightn't think of as the archetypical naturalist, with Quine. I had occasion to reread Word and Object recently. I was writing something about Quine and naturalism. And Quine's not really much of a naturalist. I mean, not least the least in Word and Object. I mean, you have a little bit where he says Carnap's program doesn't work. We can't articulate what sensory givens are from the inside. We need to bring in physiology to think about light waves hitting the retina. And so at that point, he's thinking of humans in a physical world from the outside. And having made that point, he stops doing it. And from then on, everything is constructed from the inside. The whole construction of the world in Word and Object is no different from the kind of thing that Descartes or Kant or Carnap are doing. So Kripke is the first true naturalist. So I just chuck that in. Okay, now I'm going to talk about consciousness. And let me start. Okay, I'm going to apply these issues about a posteriori necessities to the philosophy of the mind-body problem. And I'll be running through a lot of arguments that are familiar to people in the philosophy of mind from debates over the last 50 years. Let me start, it's easy to get the logic like this, somewhat anachronistically with Jackson's Mary argument, which of course arrived 15 years after similar argument, which I'll also be talking about at the end of Naming and Necessity. In fact, I should have looked this up before today. There is Adriana Romero's published a paper recently about some unpublished work of Kripke, I guess in the 70s, where he did a version of the Mary argument before Jackson. But the way it works out is slightly differently. But put that to one side. I'm going to come back to Kripke in a while. So I take it we all know the Mary argument. Mary's a future brain scientist. She's a whiz at color experiences and everything there is to do with color experiences as a scientist from the outside and so on. But she spent all her life in a black and white house and has never had any red experiences herself. And now she comes out the house and sees a red rose. Is that a red rose? A red something? And here's the argument put forward by Jackson. Beforehand, by hypothesis, Mary knew about all the physical features of red experiences. She comes out, she has this experience, and she learns about some new feature of red experiences that she didn't know before. Very plausible. She now finds out what it's like to have red experiences. She had no idea what that was like before. Therefore, red experiences have some, at least one, non-physical feature. The phenomenal feature, what it's like. Nice argument. Okay, we know how we respond. Standard physicalist responses say, Mary's been changed. Here's one way she's been changed. She's had an experience she's never had before. But of course, that's not itself an argument against physicalism. That can be agreed on all sides. She's had a certain brain processes she's never had before. But the physicists can then add in that as a result of having these processes going on in her brain, certain kind of activity, certain kind of oscillations have been simulated in V4 by the red thingy, whatever it was. She now has some new powers. She can now recreate that experience. Humean faint version of the original impression. She has now an idea of that experience. Let's suppose that she can use this power of recreation to give herself a new way of thinking about red experiences that she didn't have before because she'd never had a red experience, and this new way of thinking about red experiences requires that you be able to reactivate the part of your brain that was involved in red experiences. Mary has now a new phenomenal concept. So she can think with this new phenomenal concept P. And she can now think with a new phenomenal concept P that red experiences, the things caused by ripe tomatoes, involve P. Now, she always knew that red experiences involve oscillations phi and V4. I mean, she was a real scientist, right? Does she have any new knowledge? Well, the physicalists will say not at the level of reference. She has new knowledge only at the level of concepts. Physicists will say, look, in truth, P and phi are the same thing. What Mary is thinking, this experience, and oscillations phi and V4, just one and the same object. Of course, it's an a posteriori necessity. She mightn't yet know, having just had the experience, that, I mean, if it was a red rose, she'd know. If you just showed her a piece of red paper, she wouldn't know. She'd need to do more investigations to find out that phi, this experience, and oscillation, P, this experience, and oscillations, phi, are the same thing. From this point of view, look, it's like somebody knows about Cary Grant, read a movie magazine that Cary Grant was born in a certain hospital in Bristol. Now this person's looking at the birth records, discovers that Archie Leach is born at a certain hospital in Bristol. Now they know something they didn't know before. Maybe they don't know that Cary Grant and Archie Leach are the same person. So Cary Grant was born in the hospital. New information, Archie Leach was born in the hospital. Does that show there was an extra person born in the hospital over and above the person that the thinker always knew about? No, just that a person's got a new name for the baby that they'd always known about. This is kind of such an obvious answer to Jackson's argument that you might wonder why it seemed such a good argument at the first in the first place. Well, I mean, this response. I can't remember, Terry Horgan immediately made this response. I think Chris Peacock did. People said, no, Jackson, you've just shown there's new knowledge at the level of concepts. You haven't shown there's a new thing in reality. Truth was that until Jackson's argument came along, nobody had really thought about phenomenal concepts. In fact, the standard view was that all our concepts of mental states were behaviorist, neo-behaviorist, functionalist concepts. Think about David Lewis and Daniel Dennett, never gave that idea up. And if you think like that, then Mary is a knockdown argument. The Mary argument shows that there's ways of thinking about conscious experiences that aren't behavioral, functional, and so on. But as a result, physicalists stopped being what David Chalmers calls type A physicalists. They gave up the idea that our concepts of conscious states are all kind of behaviorist functional concepts and adopted this new idea as a special kind of way of thinking about conscious states that you have available only as a result of having had the conscious state yourself. And in fact, not only did physicalists take this moral from Jackson's thought experiment, but so did most anti-physicalists. But now there's a second wave of anti-physicalist argument that's added to Jackson's argument. And I guess, I'll just try to think about the history of the adding, but let's not go into that. The second wave says, well, that's fine. Okay, we got phenomenal concepts, and at first pass, there's nothing in Jackson's argument to show it's any different from the Archie Leach Cary Grant case. We just got two concepts refer to the same thing. But say the anti-physicalist, there's something special about phenomenal concepts that is inconsistent with the idea that we have an a posteriori necessity here. And this goes back to the first shallow Russellian idea, that if you've got an a posteriori necessity, you must be thinking at second hand. So this is the two-dimensional argument against mind-brain a posteriori identities. The thought is that, as we saw earlier, on the Russellian idea that either you refer by acquaintance or something like that, or you refer by uniquely identifying contingent description, you only get an a posteriori necessity in the second case, where you're referring by contingent description. But, and now comes the punchline, phenomenal concepts don't refer by contingent description. The thought, this feeling couldn't refer to something different in some different possible world, like the tallest possible man or the person called David Papineau might refer to something different. Rather, phenomenal concepts refer directly. So they're going to reveal the nature of their reference to the thinker. So this supposed identity, the experience, this feeling is one and the same as the neural oscillation, ought to be a priori if it was true. But it's clearly not a priori, so it can't be true. I mean, intuitive ideas, look, when we're thinking with phenomenal concepts, we're thinking about the reference directly, immediately, so all their necessary properties ought to be available to us. But you can't see when you introspect your conscious experience, that it's a physical state, that it's neural oscillations. So it can't be. That's the gist of a two-dimensional argument against materialism. Okay, I don't buy any of that argument. And that's because I denied, as I did earlier on, that a posteriori necessities require contingent description. Why can't two terms just refer to the same thing brutally without the aid of any identifying knowledge? I've got two terms, they're set up so as to refer to the same object. And in fact, back in the first lecture, we saw we get into all kinds of problems that if we suppose that as soon as you have two terms that refer to the same thing, but the subject doesn't know, they've got to be somehow semantically different. Right? That idea got us into troubles long before we started looking at consciousness. I don't see what... There's a question mark that should have come out there. I don't see what's wrong with phenomenal brain identities being, as it's sometimes said, brutally necessary. In terms that don't have to be semantically different. They can just be 2 million names. They're different names. And that's what makes the identity a posteriori. People say, well, look, if they're the same name, they've just got the same content. How is it possible for you to think P is not Q if they're just the same content? And I want to say, look, what's so hard here? I put down one name, I put down the other name, I put not equals in between, and there you are. I've managed to think a thought which is, as it were, brutally impossible. But what's the difficulty about that? That's why Ruth Millikan's book around 25 years ago was called White Queen Psychology. Alice Through the Looking Glass says to the Red Queen, I'm sorry, I just can't believe impossible things. And the Red Queen says, I dare say you haven't had enough practice. Okay. I don't want to go on too long. Here's something that you might think I ought to be worrying about. I'm saying if we understand the real Kripke, we'll see there's nothing to this two-dimensional argument against materialism, nothing to this kind of Russellian-based way of knocking out standard materialism. But slightly worrying thing is that my opponents at this point say, but look, at the end of Kripke's book, Naming and Necessity, there's just our argument. The argument we've been running is being run by Kripke. So there must be something wrong with what you've said. So this is the argument at the end of Naming and Necessity where Kripke challenges the materialist to explain the appearance of contingency of mind-brain identities. He says, look, here you're going around saying pains are C-fibers or red experiences, oscillations, phi. But Kripke says, look, this appears contingent, and you've got to explain the appearance of contingency, and you can't explain it given that your phenomenal concepts don't refer by description. And my opponents standardly read Kripke. I've got a paper where I list a dozen people, including me, reading Kripke in this way, as arguing here that the problem is that this mind-brain identity is a posteriori, and a posteriority requires terms that refer by description. And okay, I don't think that's what Kripke's doing. I don't think that line of argument is at all Kripke, and I don't think It's what Kripke is going in for at the end of naming necessity. I think what I've got here, that the appearance of contingency means a posteriority, and that the problem with phenomenal concepts is they don't refer by description. That's not Kripke's argument. In fact, let me speak more carefully. Kripke's argument does assume, as we should all assume, that phenomenal concepts don't refer by description. But what he's worrying about is not the a posteriority of mind-brain identities, but something different when he talks about the appearance of contingency. In fact, if you think about it, could Kripke really be running the argument that everybody assumes he is? What are the two main doctrines in naming necessity? One is proper names don't refer by description. We have a causal theory of reference, whole pile of arguments, they don't refer by description, people can use proper names, not have any identifying knowledge of the object at all. Proper names refer directly and externally. Premise one. Premise two. Proper name identities are a posteriori necessities. If he was running a line of argument at the end of the book, which required him to deny the conjunction of those two things, you'd expect him to say so. But he doesn't. He doesn't at any point back off either of those claims. Proper name identities clearly are a posteriori, Hesperus, Phosphorus, Marilyn Monroe, Norma Jean Baker, whatever. And proper names refer as a result of causal chains. They don't refer by descriptions. Look, here's a different argument. Kripke isn't worried about the a posteriority of the mind-brain identity. I mean, if he was, he'd say so. I mean, he'd say, look, there's a puzzle about how people can conceive this, how people could think that that was false on the materialist account. But that's not what he says. He says, the trouble with this claim is it appears contingent. Contingent being, it appears to be both true and possibly false. And his worry is, how can physicalists, who think it's true, account for this appearance? I mean, of course, physicalists, once they recollect themselves, remember what they're thinking, will say, I don't think it is possibly false. I mean, there's the feeling and the neural oscillation, the same thing, the one thing, how can they come apart? I don't think it's possibly false. But still, it looks like they owe us some explanation of what they were thinking when they thought it was possibly false. If you say to a physicalist, look, what do you think about zombies? Being just physically just like me, got no feelings. Most people say, I don't believe in that. But they won't say that whole thing doesn't make any sense. Compare it with somebody who says, look, you think Marilyn Monroe is Norma Jean Baker, right? And now imagine Marilyn Monroe not being Norma Jean Baker. The physicalists will say, well, not the physicalist, but the believer in identity will say, I don't understand what you're asking me to do. Well, what am I supposed to imagine? There's just one person there. How can I imagine them coming apart? But no, that's not what the physicalist does in connection with the mind-brain identities. They don't say, I don't understand what you're asking me to imagine. There's just one thing here. What am I supposed to imagine? So Kripke is pointing to this fact that the physicalist oughtn't to be able to entertain the idea that minds and brains come apart, given that they're committed to the identity. Once they've embraced the identity, why should they think that they can come apart? Now Kripke says, well, look here's a natural way for them to explain what they're thinking when they think the two things might come apart. They might invoke the possibility, the idea, that one of the terms, the phenomenal concept, refers by description. And then what were they imagining was that description didn't pick out the brain state. But as Kripke quite rightly observes, that explanation isn't available to the physicalist. You need some descriptions on the left-hand side, as it were, to be able to cook up a possibility that you had in mind when you were thinking that zombies were possible, that the two things might come apart. But the physicalist story that we have on the table at the moment is that you've got two terms that refer directly, and now there shouldn't be any room for you to think that that thing can come apart. What are you thinking when you think that thing can come apart? Kripke challenges the physicalist to explain on the assumption that they're thinking of pains in a way that can't come apart from the appearance of pain. They're thinking of physical states, we suppose, in the same way. How can they think that those two things might come apart? And Kripke says that's a problem for the physicalist. And indeed it is a problem for the physicalist. Look, it's different from the two-dimensional argument. It's not saying that these two terms refer directly and therefore it ought to be impossible for you to suppose that the two things come apart. Kripke doesn't have any problem with the idea that people mightn't know that P equals phi. His complaint is that after you embrace that P equals phi, how can you still think they might come apart? How are you going to explain that? And that is a real challenge for the physicalist. The physicalist can't say, oh, I'm imagining that one of the descriptions has come apart from the thing because there's no descriptions around. What's the physicalist supposed to be imagining? So that's kind of a little puzzle for the physicalist. But in fact, I think now we're clear about what's going on. It's easy enough for the physicalist to answer. And indeed, Kripke says at the end of Naming Necessity, well, the challenge is to explain away the intuition that, explain away the appearance contingency, explain away the intuition that zombies might be possible, explain away the intuition that you could have the pain without the brain state or vice versa. Well, here's another way of explaining it. Why not just acknowledge that physicalism is highly counterintuitive, that it seems wrong. Even when you're a physicalist and you looked at all the arguments, it still seems a bit weird to say this feeling and the brain state are one and the same thing. Natural thought is it's counterintuitive. Natural thought is there's two different things there. And I've always said this from the start of writing about consciousness before I got into all these semantic arguments, that what's really puzzling about consciousness is that we have this strong intuition of distinctness. We have compelling arguments in favor of materialism, and then we have the feeling that it can't be right. And the feeling has always been there. So I want to say that's why zombies seem possible to physicalists. They intuitively disbelieve their own physicalism until they remember that they're physicalists and they say, no, zombies aren't possible. It's not quite that I'm showing you why the identity seems contingent to physicalists, might seem simultaneously true but possibly false. I've got the physicalist kind of got two frames of mind. The intuitive frame of mind in which the identity seems false, and then the theoretical frame of mind in which you're committed to its being true. So there's no frame of mind in which it simultaneously seems true and possibly false, as there can't be because there's no descriptions around. But the situation where half the time you think it's true and half the time you think when you kind of slip and you let your intuitions take over you think it's false, it's close enough to its appearing contingent to explain Kripke's challenge, I think. Okay. So that leaves us with the problem. There is still a problem for physicalists. Why is it that we have this persistent intuition that mind-brain identity is false? And that's indeed a good puzzle. But it's not a new puzzle. Every materialist has always faced this issue long before we started getting into Kripke and semantic arguments and so on. In fact, outside philosophy, there are plenty of people who write books. I mean, evolutionary anthropologists, psychologists write books about intuitive dualism. There's Paul Bloom, Yale psychologist, a book called Descartes' Baby. It's called Descartes' Baby because the challenge is to explain why humans are natural Cartesians. They're mind-brain dualists. And it's kind of somehow built into our natural development, says Paul Bloom, that we should be dualists. So there are plenty of possible explanations, which I won't go into now. I mean, I've offered a few. I don't think it's an either-or thing, and you could have lots of explanations for why physicalism is so difficult to believe, but I won't go into them now. That's a subject for another day. So I'll stop at this point. Thank you.
Collège de France, le savoir en illimité. Retrouvez tous nos contenus audio et vidéo sur notre site collège-de-france.fr, les plateformes de podcast et nos chaînes YouTube.